Welcome and good afternoon to the Senior Statesman of Virginia's August program. I'm Jeff Gould, president, and I'm delighted to be back in person. We are also, I think, as you know, Zooming this out, so there are a lot of people who are on your homes watching from Zoom. And I have the real pleasure of introducing as our moderator today, Mr. Bob Beard. Bob, many of you know as a former anchor with CBS 19 here in Charlottesville, and a longtime reporter in Washington, D.C., including CNN, NBC, and Reuters. Bob, it's all yours.
All right, thank you, Jeff. We appreciate everybody being here on such a hot day. It's nice to be inside. Want to welcome everybody to the Senior Statesman Candidate Forum. Wanted to introduce our candidates first. Jennifer Kitchen, running in District 25, running against incumbent Republican Chris Runyon over there, and Democrat Sarah Radcliffe, running in District 58, running against incumbent Republican Rob Bell. Thank you both so much for showing up today. Unfortunately, both delegates, Republican Rob Bell and Chris Runyon, declined our invitation to participate in this forum today. And we're asking everybody to please fill in some questions if you have any in the audience. We'll also be taking questions on Zoom as well for our candidates. Jennifer Kitchen, District 25 is Augusta, Rockingham, Western Albemarle. It basically runs from the West Virginia line to the Charlottesville city limits. Sarah Radcliffe, District 58, from Elkton and Rockingham down to the James River, parts of Eastern Rockingham, Southern Green, Northern and Eastern Albemarle, so both very large districts in Central Virginia. We're going to start with 2 minutes of opening statements, and we've drawn names out of a hat, and we want to Jennifer Kitchen will go first. Ms. Kitchen?
Hey, y'all. My name is Jennifer Kitchen, and as we said, I'm running to represent the 25th District, which runs from Western Albemarle to the West Virginia line and does not include any of Charlottesville, Stanton, Waynesboro, or Harrisonburg because of gerrymandering, of course. This is my second time running for this seat. I ran in 19 as well, so it's good to be back. A lot of you look familiar from then. It's been an interesting 2 years to get back here. Originally, why I ran in 19, what really pushed me to run is I was working as a field organizer and knocking doors in rural Virginia, and I kept having the same conversation at every door. And it became very clear to me that the reason that was happening is because everyday folks in rural Virginia are not being represented in Richmond in a way that is meaningful. Our issues are not being addressed. And so that's why I decided to run then. That's why I'm running now. In this strange 2 year period between 19 and now, we've of course experienced the pandemic. At the beginning of 2020, I was diagnosed with cancer and an unruptured brain aneurysm. Both of those things have been addressed now. But that journey through that process, forced me to gain a new perspective about navigating the healthcare system in Virginia, specifically as a rural Virginian. And I have a lot of ideas to take to Richmond to sort of address some of those problems to help everyday people.
And Ms. Radcliffe, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I am Sarah Radcliffe. And like Jenny, I am running in the 58th district, which, as Bob said, runs from eastern Rockingham all the way down and includes actually quite a large part of Fluvanna County as well. So about 40, 50 miles all the way across, up and down. I spent 30 years working in politics and policy. I worked most of my career in the Washington, D.C. area, but I worked with state legislators from across the country. And what I learned in that time was that state legislators are the folks who affect everyday lives of us far more than almost anyone else. Congress and the presidency certainly get a lot of attention, and we all care very much about the horse race and all of the daily workings that happen there in D.C. But for the most part, places like Richmond, places like Tallahassee, places like Austin, those are where the rubber meets the road of how our lives are affected. So being a state legislator, I think, is an awesome responsibility. I also think that it's important that those folks really understand the needs of their citizens. The 58th District is a widespread, both geographically, ideology, as well as rural versus more urban and suburban. I think that after 20 years of my opponents being in the seat, it might be time for us to look at some new solutions and some new ideas for the really challenging times we have ahead. I'm hoping that my experience with state legislation, my experience in DC, will help me show up for the way that my family has risen and fallen over the decades, and that I can add my experience to help people find what they need from our government, so that the Commonwealth of Virginia is certainly showing up for all of its citizens, not just those who already are in power.
All right. Thank you again, Ms. Ratcliffe. And Ms. Kitchen, once again, we wish we had four candidates on today, but incumbent Republicans Rob Bell and Chris Runyon did decline to participate in this forum. We are taking questions from written questions from people in the audience. So please hold up your hand. Somebody will come and get them. And you can also put questions in your computer on Zoom at the bottom of your screen. We've already got a couple of questions, and I'm gonna start with Ms. Kitchen there, and we'll go to Ms. Ratcliffe after that. There's a projected Virginia budget surplus for this fiscal year of $2 billion compared to the annual budget of about $24 billion. What should be done with this money?
Rural broadband internet connection. It is the one thing that we can address and immediately affect education, healthcare, businesses, farmers, everyone. You cannot participate in society anymore without being connected to the internet. And as we saw last year with the pandemic, it was the only way we could connect meaningfully with our community. It was the only way our children could be educated. It's unreasonable to think that we won't find ourselves in that position again. And so we need to be preparing for not if, but when that happens again. Another thing, if we had been centering our disability population, our folks with disabilities who have been asking for this sort of connectivity with their communities for decades, we wouldn't have found ourselves in this situation to begin with. So this is a priority. It has been a priority for a very long time. It just took a situation where it affected more people for us to really recognize that. And now that we have that surplus, we need to responsibly put that towards internet connection.
That's right.
I'm going to second that, certainly. I also think that, you know, it isn't just about where we put the money, but how that money is delivered and how quickly and where, right? So the recent support that just this week the governor signed to from the American Rescue Act to put in extra money from not only the surplus, but then from the federal supports. Two things like broadband, $480 billion, I believe, is the amount for broadband. We need to make sure that that happens quickly in places where it has been a dire need for a very long time. It can't just be supporting those folks who already have connection now. It is about broadband access, is about healthcare, it is about education, it is about small business success. It is going to touch every sense of our lives. The other thing I think would be important for us to do with the surplus is to make sure that we have supports for working families, whether that be small business loans and grants, whether that be ensuring that childcare is available, affordable, so that folks can go back to work safely, and ensuring that we have a better and more equitable economy as we reopen and maybe revitalize what has been for a long time an upended economy out here in the Valley.
All right. Thank you both. Next question. The special session has been called. It's now been adjourned in order that legislators figure out how to spend $4.3 billion of one-time federal aid that Virginia received from the American Rescue Plan Act that Biden signed in March. What would you propose to do with that money? And maybe we can touch on some different topics that you touched on before.
I'm sorry, is the question that decision's already been made? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, the person wants to know about the one-time federal aid Virginia received from the American Rescue Plan. Uh-huh. that the legislature is currently trying to figure out what to do with. With how do you think the legislature is
doing? Do I agree with what they did?
Yeah,
about the question.
Absolutely.
So I think that there should have been more outreach to communities. I always feel like there should have been more outreach to the communities. I think that they are on the right track. I don't know that they've necessarily allocated enough money. Two things specifically like broadband. I think that often people underestimate the amount of money that that is going to take. Mm-hmm. And the real impact that that will have on daily lives. But we also, as Sarah said before, we also need to make sure that we're helping our small businesses get back on their feet. They were disproportionately affected during the pandemic. We have a lot of issues with younger folks wanting to get into things like farming. And there is a barrier to entry there when it comes to being able to afford land. And so maybe we should be looking at spending some of that money on helping some of our younger farmers get into this business, because the average age of farmers right now, I think, is around 65, and that is not sustainable. So we need to be looking for ways to make changes like that in our rural communities that will have a long lasting impact on the entire Commonwealth.
Ms. Reckon.
And I think I'll just go back to similarly, the idea that we have this tremendous opportunity to put in place new spending, new dollars for really critical issues is great. How that happens is where the rubber meets the road. We know that with broadband, for an example, for many of us who do not have access to broadband now, myself included, the costs from the companies who might provide it if they get enough people interested has been somewhere from $700 to $7,000 each household, right? To that extra half mile, that extra mile. People are very familiar with that. So how is that money going to be delivered from Richmond through the companies, through the county governments, through how that money is delivered is where we need to be paying more attention. And I agree with Jenny that making sure that the community is involved in those decisions, which means making sure that the Richmond representatives are listening to our constituents. That's where we need to get input about how this money is spent so that it can help the most people.
Thank you very much. Would you set up a broadband commission, perhaps geographically, to try and distribute this money? How would you?
I've always felt that this issue should have been addressed, much like the rural electrification project. This should be a utility. And we need to be empowering our co-ops to take more responsibility in this as well. Ultimately, there are changes that are going to have to be made at a federal level, which we can't immediately affect in Richmond except for to put pressure on our federal representatives. But there are things that are going to need to be changed so that these providers do not have an option. My mom lives on a road in Stuart Straff where at one end of the road, there's Comcast service. On the other end of the road, there's Comcast service. They will not connect the two ends because they don't see the dollar signs. So the 4 to 5 families that are living on that road are the ones that suffer. We need to make it so that these companies can't make decisions like that that impact people's daily lives. We need to make it so that they have to provide service to everyone.
As far as setting up a commission, I think that's one idea, certainly. But I think that what needs to happen is that geographically, we need to make sure that rural areas, Central Virginia, Southwest Virginia, is included in the planning of how that money gets spent. Because again, I think that Central and Northern Virginia often have more resources already. And so making sure that those are balanced for the places that have been in dire need for is a really important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Next question kind of dovetails with the expansion of broadband. What is your position on promoting career and technical education in Virginia, the trades?
Yes, we have to. They need to be as important, if not more important, when we're talking to high schoolers about their opportunities. I graduated in the 90s. It was a time where we were told, if you don't go to college, you will not be successful. That is the wrong way to be addressing high schoolers when you're talking about their futures. They definitely need to be made aware that there are these opportunities. We also need to create more opportunities. And We can do this by helping unions in the Commonwealth. They provide a lot of internships and programs where kids can go in, learn skills, learn their trade, and be making money at the same time. So at the end of this program, instead of coming out in debt, they have a career and they have a plan.
I come from a family. My father was the grew up in very rural Nebraska. He was the first to go to college on both sides of his family. His brothers and sisters include a supervisor in a cannery for 30 years, a jeweler, eventually a nurse and a therapist, and a librarian. The idea that each of us has our own future to hold is an important part. We definitely need the trades. Whether that's building the new infrastructure that's going to be coming down the pike to make us competitive worldwide, whether that's ensuring that broadband is delivered in the way that we think it should be as a utility, whether that's ensuring that pipes and bridges and new buildings and the clean economy, clean energy jobs that are going to be coming soon, hopefully to this area first, have those folks. So ensuring that the support for new trades and new tradesmen, whether it's apprenticeship programs or making sure that the right to work is done correctly, is all part of making sure that we can compete both in the Commonwealth, but certainly in the area of this area of the state.
Speaking of right to work, do you support repeal of the right to work law in Virginia?
I do. I believe that it's important for folks to be able to organize for themselves, and if they choose to, they should.
I absolutely do. My mom worked in a factory for 36 years. A lot of my childhood, she worked 7 days a week, mandatory overtime on her feet. She's had surgeries on both knees, both feet, both wrists. These are all repetitive stress injuries because of her job. If you mention unionizing at this particular factory, you were terminated. I absolutely support the repeal of right to work.
All right, thank you. As you both mentioned, you are running in gerrymandered House of Delegates districts. What do you think of nonpartisan redistricting going on right now in the Commonwealth?
So what we have right now is not nonpartisan. It's bipartisan, and that's important to distinguish that. What we had hoped for and what we did not get was a nonpartisan commission that did not include legislators. No one who is being voted into office should be able to choose their constituency. So I think that we need to continue to work towards a nonpartisan commission. That's absolutely something that we need, because until we have that, it'll still be, you know, a two-party system. Whereas with a nonpartisan commission, you give more opportunity to independent or third-party candidates being able to enter. And those are important voices that need to be heard.
I agree. I think that gerrymandering is the idea that you draw the districts to suit the incumbent, essentially. That is what has happened in historical circumstances. Certainly my opponent was very involved in the 2011 redistricting in order to make sure that all the way from Rockingham to Savannah is part of our district. It's important that we ensure that the process of representation is not leaned one way or another, either toward either party, but also toward incumbents versus new people to politics.
Great. Thank you very much. Next question is, do you support the changes made yesterday to the Virginia judicial system in the special session of the General Assembly? Anybody have any opinions on that?
I didn't do my homework, I guess. I'm sorry. I need to specifically look at that. And between phone calls and doors, I haven't done. I don't know. Maybe Sarah has gotten an opportunity to look at that since yesterday.
I think it's a good start. I think that it's really important that when we're talking about the new judicial, the way that we're going to reform the judicial system soup to nuts, that we need to be looking at community involvement. We need to be looking at making sure that folks who are in the system are part of the solution. I think yesterday's or this this past week's initiatives were a good start, but I would like to see more.
Okay. Thank you. Next question. How can the Commonwealth upgrade the Virginia mental health system? And everybody says it has massive problems and needs reform. Ms. Kitchen.
Yeah, so we need, first of all, we need to work to destigmatize even talking about mental health and just sort of embrace what that looks like. We also have a tendency, and I hate to go here, but when we're talking about reforming the mental health care system, we also need to be talking about reforming our criminal justice system, because the two are linked, unfortunately. And we end up warehousing a lot of our mentally, our people with mental illness in a way that we don't have to look at them. And we do that with all sorts of populations. So we definitely need to look at making sure that people that are in this field are being paid what they are worth. We need to look at investing money in social programs to help families be able to help their family members. And we need to make it so that when you seek out mental health care, you aren't immediately shunned or stigmatized because of your need.
Mental health care is a very personal issue to me. My mother suffered from bipolar disorder for 30 years of her adult life. And in fact, it was one of the major factors that led to her death just shy of her 60th birthday. I know how hard it can be to find mental health care when you need it. I also know how hard it can be to support those who are looking for mental health care as family members or loved ones. It is important that we do put more infrastructure in, more staff, more better trained staff, as well as to collaborate with other parts of the government, whether it's police or the school system or others who are dealing with folks who are maybe in crisis and maybe not. The other thing I think that's important for us to put into the system and into reforming the system is mental health is not just about the person on the edge of the cliff. Mental health is also about, as a daily reminder during this pandemic, we all were tested. Our mental health, our balance, our ability to care for ourselves and our loved ones was tested. We need to have mental health be just as much a part of our infrastructure system as our physical health care is. As broken as that might be, we certainly need to include mental health as a part of daily work from birth to death.
Mm-hmm. Continuing on the mental health crisis, this is a question from the audience. Virginia is in a mental health crisis and has been for decades. Delegate Rob Bell has served on the Deeds Commission for years now. Despite his presence on the commission, inpatient hospitals are denying new patients. Private hospitals keep teenage and young adult patients in guarded beds for up to 72 hours. And the wait list at Region 10 is still over 200 children long. Has the Deeds Commission failed? And what can Virginia do differently for the Commonwealth's future? Ms. Radcliffe.
I certainly support the goals of the Deeds Commission. I think it's important. Senator Deeds is certainly someone who understands at a personal level as well as a legislator what and how important mental health care is. However, I do think that they have not done enough and done it quickly enough. Again, mental health crisis is a very personal issue for me. For decades, I was called to fly in at a moment's notice when my mom was in crisis and needed a family member there to ensure what happened next. When you are that feeling of helplessness when a loved one is in trouble, and where do you go and how you turn and what happens next, is one of the most frustrating aspects of the systems being broken now. So figuring out how to find people immediate help, even if it's only short term, and then what happens after long-term crisis, the short-term crisis is over. These are things that need to be addressed. Again, I think the important aspect of this larger issue is we need a sea change in how the public, who don't have to deal with these issues on an everyday, see mental health and the mental health system. It is incumbent upon us as people in the public eye and the legislators in particular to make sure that those infrastructures are put in place to help the system get better at taking care of people as they need it.
And Ms. Kitchen, once again, has the Deeds Commission failed? And what can we do? What can Virginia do differently for the Commonwealth's future?
I'm not sure that I'm willing to say that the commission has failed, but I think what often happens is when commissions like this are formed, there you have a group of people who think that they have the solution. And their solution may even seem reasonable. But because they aren't including specific people from the community that is directly affected, they end up causing unintended consequences. And we see this over and over again. So I think what needs to happen is we need to be doing more outreach, having more facilitated conversations with directly impacted people, because that's where we're going to find our creative solution. Often these people, I mean, sit around and think about it all the time. It's their life when you're in a situation like that. So inevitably, bringing those folks to the table will help us think of a solution we haven't thought of yet.
Very good. One question from me. What do you think about the Northam administration's response so far to the pandemic? What should the state do differently? Should there be mask vaccination mandates, that kind of thing?
I think overall that Northam's approach has been responsible. I am in a unique position. I have, like I said earlier, went through cancer treatment last year. And so my choices about wearing a mask are much different. I have my immune system is compromised in a way that a lot of other people's aren't. So I think that I would like to see folks that fall into that same category thought about a little bit more, and I would actually encourage stronger and faster mask mandates as we see this new variant affecting our communities to try to not end up where we were in March of 2020. That would be great.
Ms. Ratcliffe.
I think the governor's done a very good job of following the science and trying to balance people's uncomfortability with too many mandates with the idea that we need to protect each other. Really, ultimately, the success of whether we come through this or not is going to be how well we've treated each other. And that means protecting each other as much as it does ourselves and our families. My mother-in-law, we moved her to from Florida in June of 2020. She turned 90 in March. Throughout the time that she was with us, I was very cognizant of what I was bringing home. She didn't go out, but I did. And so wearing a mask became, even after I was vaccinated, wearing a mask became important for me to protect her. I think that I know people who, for health reasons, can't be vaccinated. They would like to be, but they can. And there are people who choose not to be. But if that is the case, we need to make sure that we are able to protect as many people as possible from spreading the new variant, whether vaccinated or not. And, you know, for many of us, wearing a mask is a inconvenience. It seems an easy thing when you go into a store or when you go into a restaurant, you have to wear a shirt, you have to wear shoes. There are things that we have to do in order to participate in the economy. Seems to have a mandate for even private businesses seems a smart way to go. I think that Governor Northam has been trying to, again, balance the interests of folks' choices. What's the science that needs to, but I think we need to do more of making sure that the community understands why masks are important and vaccination is at all possible.
How do you think Virginia is doing in public education right now? K through 12. Would you want to serve on the education committee if you are so lucky to win? And what should we be doing differently?
Oh, gosh, I wish freshmen got to choose to be on a committee like that. No, that would be great. So I think that the issues that exist with public education lie in issues of funding, equitable funding, making sure that students have equitable access to education and opportunity regardless of their zip code. We need to look at the funding model. When you have a model that's based on things such as property tax in an urban area, that's great. When you're in a rural community, you can't tax what you don't have. And so we're left behind from the get-go. And we can't keep relying on our teachers to fill that gap with their own money. Our teachers are, I think I read just recently that we are 50th in what we pay our teachers, and that needs to be addressed immediately. And especially in rural areas, we see we get teachers fresh out of college. They teach in our communities for a year or two, and then they move on to where they can make more money, and who can blame them? They deserve opportunity too. But we need to make sure that that opportunity exists everywhere in the Commonwealth.
I'm a product of public schools. I went to public schools K through 12, and I believe very strongly in it. I come from a long line of educators. My mom taught community college for 15 years, and my dad was trained as an educator as well. I think that teachers, like nurses, are some of the hardest working people you'll ever meet, and they are the most often overlooked by those who don't immediately interact with them. Everyone who has a student, K through 12, knows who their teacher is, knows who and how those are, they affect their lives on a daily basis. The pandemic taught us how essential a good teacher can be, how innovative they had to be. We need to make sure that we're supporting them. I think we need to do a better job. I absolutely agree that making sure that every student, every class, every school is supported financially, but also from the community, regardless of their zip code. And that needs to be a difference in the way that we fund public schools.
Mm-hmm. I have run out of questions from all but one here on the podium. So if anybody has any questions, please write them down and give them to the folks in the audience who are coming around. We'll also take your questions as well on Zoom. Once again, if you're just tuning in, we are with Jennifer Kitchen, Democrat running for the House of Delegates from District 25, and Sarah Radcliffe, Democrat running for the House of Delegates from District 58. The incumbent Republicans, Rob Bell and Chris Runyon, declined their our invitation to attend this Senior Statesman of Virginia Forum today. And we do have some new questions right here. Thank you. Thank you all for submitting your questions. What is your perspective on ranked choice voting?
Can we do it already? And again, excuse me, that goes back to giving a voice to third party and independent candidates, right? A lot of times people end up voting for the Republican or the Democrat because they want their vote to count or to matter. And in a ranked choice system, you can still vote for your specific thoughts and values, even if they don't align directly with one of the major parties. And then you can rank the others. It gives you more of an option. It actually makes your vote count more.
I think that the Democratic primary this cycle was an important lesson for those of us who have been talking about ranked good choice voting for a long time. We had a bounty of choices, a plethora of blessings in the really strong candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. The more recognized, better funded candidates ultimately, I think, rose to the top because they were better funded and more recognized, not necessarily because that many more people absolutely aligned with them. Being able to give voice to the people who support different aspects of the platform, who support different aspects of their policy positions, and then giving more opportunity for newer candidates, for differently experienced candidates, for folks from different walks of life, from folks from especially in a statewide race or in a national race, folks from different parts of the Commonwealth. So I think it's important that it gives us more choices, not less.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Questions continue. This is for Sarah Radcliffe and also for Ms. Kitchen. What exactly will you do to protect clean air, clean water, and open spaces in Virginia?
So some of the really important steps that have been taken to open up new clean energy and new economic development from the clean energy sector, I think is going to be important, but it is also critical that we don't go backwards. There's lots of places in the United States where those infrastructure has not been supported. In Virginia, that has certainly been an important aspect of who we are and how we. When my husband and I found our house in Greene County and chose to move to the Central Virginia Valley, one of the reasons that we did so is because of our love of the area, the open spaces, the resources, the natural resources that are here, and how beautiful it is. I want to make sure that that gets protected, and it will make it important for folks, whether it's about tourism, whether it's about healthcare, health aspects of clean air and clean water, but also about making sure that we're doing the economic development in a safe way.
Ms. Kitchen.
Okay, so I am a supporter of the Virginia Green New Deal. All of the elements of that, creating more green energy, sustainable jobs. We need to look at making it easier for farmers to get into solar. There have been several opportunities for farmers, specifically in Augusta County, to have solar arrays on their farm that would produce an income for them, something that they can reliably count on, something that farmers don't often have. And they are met by the County Board of Supervisors with a no every single time at every single turn. We need to make it easier for farmers to diversify and have more reliable income. We also need to be supporting our farmers when we make requirements of them to do specific things like stream remediation, putting in those fences to keep the cows out of the river. That is something that we absolutely need, but it's also something that we need to support because that is incredibly expensive and the maintenance is a lot, depending on how much property this particular farmer has. Land and wildlife conservation is something that I've been passionate about my whole life. I was part of a group that helped reintroduce elk to Southwest Virginia, and I am very passionate about reintroducing more of our native species, both plants and animals, to help remediate some of the problems that we've caused.
Thank you very much. This is a continuing theme about farmers. According to FarmAid, 90% of a family's income comes from outside employment. How will you give small farms more access to capital?
Yeah, so I alluded to this a little bit earlier. I would like to make it easier for our aging farmers to work with younger people who are meeting that barrier, that cost barrier to entry, creating some sort of program so that they can work together, so that there's some sort of transfer, so that we don't lose that farm and we have someone else going into the industry. We also need to be working to help our farmers achieve some of their goals. There are lots of things that I'm sure that they would like to do to help diversify. But when you're relying on most of your income coming from outside of your farm, it's really hard to balance those things. So what can we do directly to help our farmers? And what the way we're going to find that answer is bringing them to the table. They are ultimately the ones that will help us find the solution to that problem.
Ms. Radcliffe.
The era of people passing generations of farming down, the idea that a family of 10 or 12 was going to maintain the farm and then pass it down to the generations and split up the big family farm into smaller farms and continue that tradition is largely not happening anymore. Unfortunately, farming has become one that is difficult to keep people involved, mainly because it isn't sustainable for them to support their families, as well as it's a very hard way of life. But I completely agree with Jennifer when she says that we need to make sure that we're seeking solutions from the community that's affected. We need to find more ways to support those younger generations who are interested in farming, whether that be, again, apprenticeships or programs within the public schools to support farming information and supports about how to keep the family farm going, as well as finding ways to expand new opportunities like solar arrays, like other ways that the new economy is going to come through. How do we make our farmers work with that rather than against it?
Thank you. interesting question about the environment. How important is net zero carbon by 2050? And is it even possible given our political divisions right now?
I mean, I think it's important to the continuation of our species and the health of our planet. Is it achievable? I don't know.
I think goals are important. Mm-hmm. I think that setting a goal and trying to meet it is an important activity. Whether or not we get there is about how well we do that, mm-hmm. how well we work together, how well we are open to new ideas and new ways to find different solutions. Then what we've continuing to be doing is the end of our species. We mm-hmm. need to do something different. So we need to find new ways to do that. I think that the idea that each of us has a footprint, the idea that each of us is part of the solution is needs to be better socialized, needs to be better understood. I think explaining what that means to a lot of people, what net zero carbon footprint means, is something that most people, I think, probably would struggle to explain. The folks who are in Richmond and in local board of supervisors that are trying to ensure that their people are cared for and that our environment is also cared for need to balance understanding what and how we as citizens are part of that process.
Yeah, I think it's important to address what's going on in our social environment and how that is impacting how we can actually save our actual living environment. Mm-hmm. And until we come to a place where we can have productive conversations about anything mm-hmm. And find solutions for anything, which is what we've been struggling with, how can you answer that? But hopefully we can get voices who are willing to bring other people to the table, not be the one that says, I have the best idea, but let's come together and find the best idea together.
Right. As you know, the environment and economic development kind of go hand in hand, especially Absolutely. In Tidewater, where there's a problem with sea level rise coming in down in Virginia Beach and Norfolk. How would you evaluate the success of Governor Northam's programs for economic development today, Ms. Radcliffe?
Protecting the environment and ensuring economic development do go hand in hand. I think my understanding of the governor, especially because he does come from the Tidewater area and has experience in that community, is certainly something that he's tried to move forward with. I think that moving forward, it really is about education and understanding. I believe strongly that voting and participation in the electoral process, in the policy process, in the daily lives of how we do things needs to be expanded. I think that the more people that are involved, the better likely this solution is to be successful. I also, as Jennifer mentioned, I believe that we need to be talking to each other and not at each other. Mm-hmm. I think that the balance of hearing people who are concerned that economic development that has an eye toward environment is going to close their business or is going to make it more difficult for them to succeed in business is something that we need to do. I think that the governor and this administration has tried its best to move the needle toward better and more solution-based policy. I think that we need to continue that. But until and unless we get more people involved in the process, it will always be a few who are involved, then it's going to be few who are affected.
Ms. Kitchen.
I often have frustration around the idea when we're talking about the environment and then the economy and these things balancing out. A lot of times we talk about things in geographic regions. And what we need to be talking about is how, while we can separate them on a map, they're all connected. So when you're talking about the health of the bay, you also need to be talking about the health of the headwaters, which are actually in Augusta County, in that area. So we need to be looking at this as the entire Commonwealth. What happens in the Shenandoah Valley affects the coast. And we need to be looking at whole solutions and the economy and all of these things, how they interact and are entwined. The entire Commonwealth and then the rest of the country. It's a whole problem, not mm-hmm. not segmented.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Governor Northam, here's an interesting question. Would you support a constitutional amendment to allow the governor of Virginia to serve two consecutive terms? Why or why not? Ms. Ratcliffe.
Having had experience working in state government or with state government for many, many years, it's fascinating to me that Virginia's is one term requirement is one that most people don't, outside of Virginia, certainly don't really even understand. I think there's a benefit to not having to run again to the policies that governors make. But I also think that in these times, especially, 4 years is not very long to make things happen, especially when we're talking about the major shift and sea change that we need to come together and solve some of these really challenging issues. So I think that a constitutional amendment is required, of course, here in Virginia to do that. And I think that I'm always about when people get more involved in changing things. So I think that it would be, I would like to see the process happen. Sure.
Ms. Kitchen.
I'm going to be the odd one, I guess. I don't think that I would support that amendment. I think that term limits and keeping specifically the position of governor, and you can hold more, you can hold the office more than once, of course, as we're seeing, but I think one term is a good limit at the level of governor.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. This is a question about the state economy and the budget that the House of Delegates just passed with the existence of surpluses. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion of retiring debt and holding taxes steady in Virginia, rather than perhaps increasing them over time? What's your position on the income tax, where we are right now, I guess?
Sure. I think that coming out of a pandemic, a lot of people are concerned about this, and I think that it is a good opportunity, a good time to be having this discussion, how we can keep that steady for a while and let people get back on their feet and find new normal. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely a conversation we need to have. Yeah.
I think that we've been having a discussion before the pandemic about the rise in student debt, mm-hmm. and the rise in our young people being saddled with debt early on in their adult lives. I think that it isn't just the case. For many of us, we lived our whole lives trying to balance paying for the things that we had to get done and making sure our families were taken care of. I think that tax increases are an important tool, but it can be unnecessary. We are fortunate to have the surplus that we have. We also need to use it wisely. And I think that the most recent, the special session and the idea that they set aside some of that pot of money for to figure out what we're going to do to sustain the after the post-pandemic economy is an important step toward that. So I think that it is a balance.
Thank you. We're going to move from the budget to education again. This is a question about education policy. What is your view on the critical race theory debate? And we're going to start with Ms. Kitchen.
Okay. So critical race theory is not something that is taught in Virginia public schools. This is a college course that folks have to seek out. I think a lot of people who are upset about critical race theory could not define it if they were asked. But I think that what we are seeing happening in our society should maybe make people think that maybe there are elements of this that we should be teaching.
My understanding, as Jennifer mentioned, is that critical race theory was a law school curriculum that was is about how and what critical race law is adjudicated. It is about history, though. You know, my stepson went through Virginia public schools, and he, in fourth grade, I believe, had to learn Virginia history. I think it's important for us to understand where we came from, what we did or didn't do that we might do differently. I think it's important for us to talk about what and how the Native American history in Virginia, as much as the colonial history. I think it's important that we talk about what and how voting rights or civil rights or other aspects of our history happened or didn't or should have. I don't think critical race theory is the answer for public K through 12, but I think that we need to look at our history so that we don't repeat it.
This is a question for Jennifer Kitchen, but both of you can answer it. What will you do to help mitigate the effects of Virginia's years of racial discrimination?
Bring Black people to the table and give them a voice and a position to tell their stories and help them, again, bring people to the table to help find a solution. Okay, I'm not going to sit here as a white woman and say that I have the solution to these problems. And I think that that is a problem that has happened for far too long. And so that is my plan, to give a platform for those voices that haven't been heard.
Ms. Ratcliffe.
One of the elements of my campaign that's most important to me is the willingness to have difficult conversations, whether that be about issues, whether that be about struggle, whether that be about how we need to change ourselves and our society. The need for us to hear some of the difficult experiences that others outside our own demographic have had, and what and how we might need to change in order for that to change, is important to how we're going to get to how we're going to move forward. We've spent a lot of time at the national level, and certainly in some state spaces as well, talking at each other. There's a lot of that goes on. But when you sit around the kitchen table, when you go to church in the morning, when you go to the PTA meeting, most people are having conversations with each other. We need to figure out a way to do that on a wider scale. I think that race is just one of the issues where we need to hear from more voices. Mm-hmm. And we need to really be willing to hear the uncomfortable positions and the uncomfortable experiences that others have had, and figure out what to do next. Because ultimately, it is about what do we do next, not where we've been, not what's wrong with the society, not what we need to change, but how do we do that? What do we do next? But listening and having a conversation is one of the main ways that I know to get through that divide that has been so strong for so many years.
What do you think we need to do in the state to make sure we don't have another Unite the Right rally or another January 6th insurrection?
Yeah.
I don't know if the legislature can do anything about that, but
I don't know if this is something that can be solved legislatively, but I've been a community organizer for a long time and have navigated some very complicated issues around organizing and letting people tell their own stories, not telling their stories for them. And so I think that that's a huge part of it. And like Sarah was saying, it's not just them telling their uncomfortable story. It's us sitting in the uncomfortable truth and understanding that this is not just somebody's story. This is their life. And we need to be willing to stand up for those people. And sometimes there are going to be hard legislative decisions that need to be made. There may be some things that can be done on a local level when it comes to maybe some of the things from Charlottesville could have been stopped if there were different permitting processes in place. You know, we can sit back and think about all of the ways maybe we could have done that differently, but is that helpful? I'm not sure. I think that we just need to change the way that we are communicating with people on a daily basis and actually listen when people are talking and not just be waiting for our turn to respond emotionally.
Ms. Reckler.
I think that the rise of social media, the rise of misinformation, the rise of people spewing their own version of facts can be tied directly back to where and how we got here. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that having conversations with people who are different than you, whether that be someone who disagrees with you politically, someone who comes from a different background, someone from a different part of the state, someone whose ideas about what we need to do to solve these problems is the opposite end. We need to have those conversations. My read of what and how both the Unite the Right experience and the January 6th insurrection was that people felt they weren't being represented. They felt they weren't being heard. They felt that they were being, something was being taken from them. I don't agree with that position. I don't think that's what was happening at all. But just saying they're wrong isn't going to get it done. We need to have the conversation and hear from both sides of every issue why people feel the way they do, and then try to figure out how to move forward together. It's not a pie. It's not yours or mine. It's not either or. It's both and. We need to figure out how to move together as a society. We need to come back to the idea that we, all of us, are a community. When you meet someone in the grocery store, when you meet someone in the community, neighbors know each other well and often speak to each other. As we've become more divided, those taking up either side has been become a flag we wave. But the truth of the matter is we're still very much more alike than we are different, and we need to figure out a way to move past the divide. I think that that's how we stop January 6th from happening again.
Thank you very much. We have had a couple of questions on guns. For Sarah, what specific research on gun violence do you propose? For Jennifer, what is your position on gun control? I guess we'll just kind of have those two together. What is your position on research on gun violence and on gun control overall?
Sure. So I am a Moms Demand Action supported candidate. I support that organization and everything that they are doing. As far as gun control, I am a gun owner. I'm a hunter. I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley with farmers and hunters as family members. That being said, common sense gun legislation has to happen. It is a public safety issue. And we have not done enough. We need to do more to strengthen things like red flag laws to support survivors of domestic abuse situations to keep them safe. And we need to hold people responsible for their, if you own a weapon, you need to be responsible for storing that in a safe way within your home so that accidents can't happen.
I too have been designated as a common sense gun candidate by Moms Demand. And I think it's an important organization and the work that they and their colleagues do. Responsible gun ownership is a responsibility, right? It isn't just about, it's not about taking anything from someone. It's about ensuring that people are doing what they need to do when they own guns or when they do hunt or when they do have guns as sportsmen, whatever the reason. My husband grew up in South Central Texas. Certainly gun ownership and being comfortable around and with guns is something that I came to understand as a married person to a Texan. So I think that as far as when it comes to research, it's important that we, you know, the vast majority of gun violence, as I understand it, especially when it comes to children, is when accidents take children's or have accidents happen to children. People not being responsible about storing their guns, people not teaching their children about guns and to respect that. All of those things are, so research on how we could better support those policies, how we could make education for gun responsibility more available, I think is important. I think that research on what and how we can stop the violence is important for us to figure out how to support policy that would do that.
Thank you very much. We have one question on criminal justice. This is for Sarah, but I'm going to, you both can answer it. How will you help recently incarcerated people reenter society? Issues include jobs, housing, and health care. So people who have been in jail, they've been released. How do you help them?
Criminal justice reform has to include what happens when someone has paid their debt. I think that the stigma of folks who have been through the criminal justice system and who have been incarcerated can be a weight that is, that can be a weight around someone's shoulders. I think that we need to make sure that the transition, whether it's halfway houses or programs to help re-enter society and find opportunities, go back to maybe find new education, some of the trades that we talked about earlier, some of the economic supports that we could do for increasing the trades, that might be another opportunity for folks who are recently incarcerated. I also think that it's important for us to realize that many of the people who are incarcerated might not have been if our policies were different about how we treat different folks in the criminal justice system itself. So I think that making sure that the supports that we have for folks who come out of the system are spread across the demographics as well is an important part of it.
Yeah, so the entire criminal justice system needs to be reformed. But when we're looking specifically at reentry, we need to make sure that we are not setting people up for failure. We've created a system where it's virtually impossible to get out of. It's a revolving door. They're just waiting for you to return. And it's because there are barriers to housing. There are barriers to employment. You may have served your debt to society, but then you are, as soon as you're out, you're unable to get housing and a job. How do you feed yourself? We're creating a new jail for them to navigate with no support. So what community, what social programs can we have in place to immediately help those folks learn skills, learn trades, and then how do we break down these barriers for housing and employment in general? We stigmatize folks. There are could be any number of reasons why that person was incarcerated, and there are going to be a lot of people who are coming out who had been incarcerated for things that are now perfectly legal. That is something that we have to address. So creating, does that look like a new social program or just making sure that the current programs are funded well enough to help that population? I'm not sure. But we definitely need to make sure that there are not immediate barriers to their just existing once they're out.
Thank you very much. This is a question about something we talked about earlier in the forum about right to work laws. This is for Jennifer, but you both can answer it. Won't eliminating right to work laws make Virginia less attractive to business, which in turn will lead to lower employment?
Yeah, this is something that people toss around a lot, and I really do not think that that's the case. I think that there are lots of opportunities to build, when you give people the opportunity to organize and make sure that they are well taken care of, wouldn't more people want to work there? And doesn't that create a better environment for everyone? And wouldn't that be more attractive to employers? I think that there's a two sides to that. Only one side really gets talked about. And I think we need to address the importance of unions and people being able to organize for themselves. And when you're organizing with your coworkers, you're organizing with your community, and you're making the entire space better.
Ms. Ratcliffe.
I agree. I think that the right to work issue needs to be about workers as much as it is about business, because business is not going to be attracted to Virginia if no one wants to work here. So the idea that we are a state that supports the folks who do the trades, the folks who work and organize for themselves to decide, and whether that be tradespeople themselves or also the public sector is another place, whether that's firefighters and law enforcement, whether that's public service employees who often don't have the option now because of the right to work law to organize for themselves and to protect themselves, especially in this last year and a half when the pandemic showed how critically important our public service employees were, public health and other sectors. It shouldn't be that you have to give up your rights to go work for your local government or state government. So I think it's an important aspect to make sure that the workers' rights, the workers' health and happiness, Virginia should be a state where workers want to live as well as business.
Yeah, I find it interesting that Virginia is often number one for business and last for workers. We need to have a real, we need to think about, do we want to prioritize ourselves and our community or the people that we work for?
Thank you very much. This is a question from the audience about something I have never thought of. Interesting. Would you support allowing localities to enact anti-idling ordinances to reduce carbon emissions? The Dillon Rule prohibits such actions. This person points out that 10 seconds of idling your car is the amount of gas it takes to turn off the motor and then turn it back on.
I was not aware of that. That's fascinating. I absolutely support getting rid of the Dillon Rule. Mother May I rule in state government is ridiculous. We should not have people in Richmond making decisions for towns that they can't point to on a map. So, yeah, I support getting rid of the Dillon Rule. And if a locality decides that that is the way that they want to go, then sure.
I think that having local control is very, very important. Again, like the as Jennifer mentioned, the idea that the communities where people live and work should be in charge of their destinies and their and the laws that, that support them. However, I think it's important for us to also balance that with state level protections, whether that's about worker protections or environmental protections or what have you. I think when it comes to the idling, auto idling, I will be honest with you. I had also never thought about that in particular as a, as something that people would force folks to not have the 10-second rule. I think that the idea about how local and state governments is a bigger issue. I think in particular, that would be something that each and every community would have to decide for themselves.
Thank you. This is a question for Jennifer, but you both can answer this. This is for Jennifer Kitchen. As a newcomer to politics who's, quote, not wealthy or connected, as your website says, how do you expect to get elected? And if you do, make a difference in the Virginia State Legislature?
Sure. So how do I expect to get elected? Well, I've been fundraising since February. I've been making at least, well, for a while, 500 phone calls a day. I'm calling voters. I'm knocking on doors. I'm having... For a long time, there were Zoom events. We are trying to connect with as many voters as possible because right now the important thing is that people know that I exist and that in November they have an option. Well, actually, I guess starting in September with early voting. But I absolutely think that it is a possibility to win this district. What we have to do is make sure that people understand, you know, in Virginia, we have an election every single year. We need to make sure that people understand that they don't get a break. And that they show up and vote. Turnout is going to matter. And so that's what we're doing. We're contacting as many people in as many different ways, email, phone, knocking on the doors, sending them snail mail, all of the things. And as far as being a newcomer and not a connected person, I'm a community organizer. I'm not a politician. I have conversations. I meet people where they are and I help find solutions. And that's what we need in Richmond.
Ms. Ratcliffe.
While I have been in the business of politics for most of my career, I am a first-time candidate, so I don't know if that makes me put on both sides, perhaps. But my family has always, I also did not come from wealth or power in political power, but my family has always believed that voting is a responsibility. It's a duty that we have to show up. Decisions are made by those who show up. Thank you to all of you who showed up here today, including Jennifer and myself. So I think that the idea that we're going to get elected by half the population or a quarter of the population because they agree with us is not sustainable. We need to get more people involved. We need to have conversations with people who say, well, the people in DC, the people in Richmond, they don't know me. They don't, my vote doesn't matter. I don't have time. It's not my job to pay attention to politics. Those are the folks that I want to vote for me. Those are the folks that I want to talk to because I want them to understand how and why they are the bosses of the people who are in Richmond and they need to get involved. And the way you can get involved is with your vote. at minimum, raising money and ensuring that people, you know, support our candidacies and our campaigns is important, certainly for us. But the easiest thing you can do is to show up and vote. And now we've made it much easier to do that. And I think that it's an important part of us, our responsibility as community members. My grandfather was born and raised in the South Side of Chicago. He was an avid voter. In 1996, he was in the hospital. He was on his deathbed. And he made sure that he got his absentee ballot in before he passed away in the afternoon of Election Day. So it is important to us that we participate in any way we can. And the first and most easy way to do that is to add our vote.
The census was delayed. If I recall, the data is going to be given to the new redistricting commission, looks like at some point before the end of the year. Should this fall's election have been postponed somehow by the Commonwealth?
Absolutely.
Waiting for the new lines to come in?
Absolutely not. And I can't speak for Sarah, but I know I am planning to on running the next 3 years in a row. My plan is running this year, of course. Next year, we expect for there to be a special election for the new redistricting. And then the regular election would then be in 2023. And I plan to be on the ballot for all of those.
Ms. Radcliffe.
Virginia's the birthplace of democracy. We vote here every year, as Jenny said. We vote for state level in the odd numbered years and federal and president in the even numbered years. The fact that we're going to have to run as state level candidates, perhaps for 21, 22, and 23, is just part of the game. If we want to be involved, if we want to speak out, if we want to represent our community, that's what needs to be done. The more people that get involved and make sure their voices are heard, the better off we'll be.
We have time probably for a couple more questions. This is one about politics as well. How will you address the integrity of our elections, and how would you respond to claims that elections are rigged?
Oh, boy.
I could probably go on for hours.
Let's just go with I do not believe that our elections have been rigged. I think that our process is very safe. I think that voting absentee voting by mail is very safe. And, you know, if we were to go to simply just paper, maybe that would solve some problems. But I don't think that our elections are in as much danger as some people would lead us to believe. That's how I'll say that.
Ms. Rackley.
The fact that as many people were elected that I disagree with
exactly
is proof to me that our elections are not rigged. I think that the United States is the envy of the world in how well and how professionally and how safely and how much integrity our elections hold. That has not changed. The fact that folks who are trying to gin up trouble, who are trying to change who has power or hold on to who has power in this country, does not change the facts that we that our elections are safe and our elections have integrity, and that election results, if you don't like the people that are representing you, wait 2 years, or here in Virginia, wait 1 year and you get to do it again. So showing up and making sure that folks participate with in all the ways that that's possible is the way that we keep the integrity in our elections.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question on a card. The first word is seriously. Why do you think the Republicans regretted, I imagine, not attending this forum today? What's your reaction to your challengers, the incumbents, Rob Bell and Chris Runyon, not appearing today?
I believe my opponent thinks that the R behind his name is all that he needs to win this election, and I plan to prove him wrong.
I can't speak for Rob Bell. I wouldn't try to. I think that my goal in this campaign is to offer a choice to the voters of the 58th district, a choice that has experience, a choice that's professional, a choice that's reasonable, a choice that's willing to hear and listen. I would like to represent everyone in the 58th district. whether they have an R or a D behind their name or not either. I think that forums like this are an extraordinarily important opportunity for us to talk directly to the folks who are going to make that choice in November. I can't explain why he's not here, but I'm glad I am.
And I will say, well, I can't speak for Chris Runyon, of course. Since starting this campaign, we have had multiple people reach out to us for constituent services. I think him not being here is also him not being there for his constituents. And the people of the 25th district deserve someone that is willing to work for them.
Mm-hmm. And we have a couple more questions. This is for Sarah regarding veterans. Mm-hmm. What is your plan to support veterans in Virginia as they return to civilian life? And then we'll, Jennifer can answer that question as well.
Folks who serve in our military, whether they serve for one tour or a lifetime, we need to make sure that those folks are, we give back to those folks who do that really important job when they transition back to civilian life. Again, whether it's for 4 years or whether it's for 20 or more, figuring out how to navigate a brand new housing, whether to figure out how to navigate the really complicated veterans healthcare system, mm-hmm. whether to figure out how to come out and go back to school if they're going to do that, or to start their new career if it's not in between education. The important supports of that, it's unbelievable that the amount of paperwork and the amount of confusion about what happens next when you leave the military. I have a number of really close family friends and folks here in Virginia who are military families, and leaving the military is bittersweet on most occasions. Making sure that they can be successful in their next life is really an important part of what we need to give back to them in their service to our country.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to work to simplify and streamline that transition to reentry. That is, I think a lot of times there are services available to folks, but they are unaware of it, or the paperwork, the navigating how to acquire those services is almost a full-time job. And we need to make sure that people understand what they qualify for, what services are available to them, and then make it as easy as possible for them to then receive those services. And instead, we really seem to be working in the opposite direction.
Absolutely. Very good. So we've got about 10 more minutes or so until 3 o'clock. I'm just wondering, what is it like campaigning right now in a gerrymandered district in Virginia? But are there some interesting stories that you can tell everybody from the campaign trail? And we'll start with Ms. Radcliffe, if you'd like to talk about that.
Sure. So the 58th district, again, is diverse. It's very rural, as well as the suburbs and close in to Charlottesville and the suburbs around it. It's also diverse, I believe, ideologically. You know, the idea that we all think the same and it's just going to be the same old is not true. We're all different, and we all have experienced the last couple of years, 3 or 4 years, through our own lenses. Talking to folks, the thing that I've heard the most that surprised me the most is, yeah, I could see it might be time for a change. 20 years is a long time for somebody to be in that same job. I'm like, great. I think for me and for my campaign, the idea that the more conversations we can have, I'm struck on a daily basis by how much more we are alike than different. Even people who agree on nothing politically still have to send our kids to school, still have to make dinner every night, still have to make sure our, you know, dog gets all the belly rubs that he deserves, like whatever it is. I think that my experience navigating three different parents through the end of life has really crystallized for me how very similar we all are. And that has been my experience in campaigning, is if you can find that thing that someone understands it the same way you do, then you have the start of a conversation. I think that campaigning is for me, and sometimes people like me, is fun to have those conversations. My husband would disagree, but I think that that if you start out a campaign like this, thinking that you're going to change people's minds, then you're probably going to lose. I think that the idea of the campaign is the more conversations you have and the more people you can get to know, the better we'll be, win or lose.
Yeah. So campaigning this year has been night and day from campaigning in 19. All of the different safety things that we think about on a daily basis as a campaign, we're constantly talking about, do we need to rethink what we're doing? Are we keeping our community safe? That's always in the forefront of our minds. It's very important for us to have conversations, and most importantly, conversations with people that don't necessarily think the same way. I had a conversation with someone on a door last week. I was there actually to speak with his daughter, who wasn't home, but I started a conversation with him. He happens to be a Republican. I always canvass in a mask. And he got this little, you know, that swagger that people get when they're going to really just tell you about yourself and how what you're doing isn't. So he asked me, he was like, you know, are you vaccinated? Why are you wearing a mask? And I explained to him my health history and why I was wearing that mask. And his tone immediately changed. He realized in that moment that he was wrong. And he was there to listen to what I have to say next. We had a great conversation about issues. He kept trying to take conversation to the federal level. I kept bringing it back down to the local level, and we agreed on everything we talked about. I think a huge problem is that some people are confused about the separation of what do we do at the state level and what happens at the federal level. And when you're only looking at that letter after the person's name, you don't think about things like that. So those are that's one of the really great conversations that I had, and I hope to have many more like it. But it's interesting how many doors this thing's opened up, and conversations that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I wouldn't have spoken to them otherwise, because I would have just gone on to the next door because the person I was there to talk to wasn't there.
All right. Thank you both very much. I have run out of questions here on the podium. So I think it's time to go to closing statements. So you each have 2 minutes for closing statements, and we will begin with Ms. Radcliffe.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here and for inviting me today. My story is one that started out with not very much. I was raised by a single mom. She had many struggles. Really, I saw what happens when people are left behind and left out. I was fortunate enough to be able to go and get a good, solid education. I was fortunate enough to embark on a career that I have loved, that let me see how government can be good for people's lives and how government can make people's lives easier and better. One of the things that I believe strongly is that no one in my experience is looking for a handout. Unemployment, food stamps, housing supports, all of the programs that folks talk about all the time, Medicaid and Medicare, all of the programs that people talk about all the time aren't about handing out. They're about helping up. Many people in this country need a hand up. We need to make sure that more people have support and understand the services that are available to them so that we can all rise together. I know that I've been very lucky in my life to get to the place where I have. I believe it is a blessing that I was able to find this community, and I want to represent each and every one of them in the 58th district. I believe that I have the experience to do that. I know what it takes to be a legislator after all of my career working with legislators, but I also know what it's like to be a community member. As I mentioned earlier, I had the blessing and curse to navigate the end of life for my mother before she turned 60, my father at 64 from early onset Alzheimer's, and most recently in May, we lost my mother-in-law at 90. So those experiences taught me what it can be like on a daily basis to figure out how and what you need to do while still trying to maintain all of the reasons that we need to show up for each other. That's what my campaign is about, showing up for each other. I think that 20 years is a long enough time to try out the same ideas and the same solutions and have the same people in charge. It's time for a change, and I hope I'm that change for the 58th.
Thank you, Ms. Kitchen.
Yes, thank you all for being here, and those who are joining us virtually, thank you. I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley. I've been a rural Virginian my entire life. I have never seen myself in my representation in Richmond. I have two kids. I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. It is very important to me that they not grow up with the same issues that I did. And so that is another one of the big reasons why I am running, is to make sure that rural Virginians are taken seriously and are given the priority that we deserve. I would love to have individual conversations with any of the people here. If you know someone that you feel like I just need to talk to them, please reach out. The easiest way to reach our campaign is through the website, which is electjenniferkitchen.com.
All right. Thank you both for coming here today. Once again, you've been watching the first of the year candidate forum from the Senior Statesman of Virginia. We've been listening to Jennifer Kitchen, Democrat running for District 25, Augusta, Rockingham, and Western Albemarle County, and Sarah Radcliffe, District 58, which runs from Elkton and Rockingham down to the James River. And unfortunately, their Republican opponents, incumbents Rob Bell and Chris Runyon, declined our invitation to participate today. We thank you all there in the audience for coming in and watching this. And thanks as well to everybody watching on Zoom. And we want to remind everybody you can start voting early, I believe, in September
18th.
September 18th. And of course, Election Day is the first Tuesday in November.